So now we are about to attend an online talk by Julie Rosenberg.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Julie Rosenberg. I'm a senior economist at the World Bank. And I'm sorry that I cannot be in Paris with you in person. I am recording my presentation from Washington. The work that I'm about to present is some work that I've been doing over the years at the World Bank with some colleagues, notably Stéphane Algat, Brian Walsh, and Bramka Jafino. It's based initially on the report that is called Shockwaves that we published in 2014. And there was a paper in Nature Climate Change that presented our first results. And then we updated them in 2020 with more recent household data and climate impacts data. The objective of this work is really to assess the future impacts of climate change on poverty and inequality. And the reason why we did this is because the shocks that will get worse with climate change are actually the same shocks that today are pushing people into poverty or keeping people into poverty. And there's many of those, but there's three main groups of shocks that are really worrying. One of them is the impacts of climate change on agriculture and on food prices. Most poor people depend on agriculture for their revenues. The share of poor people who work in agriculture is much higher than in other sectors. And poor people also spend a larger share of their income for food. So when food prices increase, they're really hit really hard. And poor people that are farming are also hit really hard. And we're seeing right now is the increase in food prices because of the war, compounded by droughts in some places around the world, that increases in food prices can be really bad for food security and poverty. Now, there's another group of shocks that is natural disasters that are going to get worse with climate change, that are going to get more intense and more frequent, and that are also affecting poor people more than the rest of the population. And that's because poor people sometimes live in areas that are more risky because they don't have any other areas where they can live, but especially because they're also more vulnerable to the impacts of natural disasters, because their assets are assets that are more vulnerable. For example, they live in very precarious housing that can be destroyed very easily by a storm, but also because all the assets they own are goods that they own in nature and that they have in their house. They don't have a lot of their wealth in a bank account or financial institution. So when they're hit by a natural disaster, they lose most of what they own, and they often don't have access to insurance to cover those losses. Now, finally, a third group of climate impacts that is very worrying for poverty is all the impacts that happen through health. So increase in the prevalence of some diseases like vector-borne, waterborne diseases, and also the increase in extreme heat that tend to affect people who work outside more. So what we wanted to do is really be able to quantify those impacts and give an estimation of how bad they can be in the relatively short term, which is 2030. But in order to discuss how climate change will affect poverty by 2030, we need to first project poverty by 2030. And that's actually quite difficult to do, because obviously the impacts of climate change will not be the same if the population that we're projecting in 2030 looks a lot like what it is today in a lot of low and middle income countries living in precarious housing, no access to water or sanitation, or if everyone has access to decent standard of living and basically if the sustainable development goals have been reached by 2030. So because we don't know, we have to build alternative scenarios and project climate change impacts in each of those alternative scenarios. In order to do that, we are going to use a microsimulation model, and we will combine assumptions on a range of important parameters that are uncertain. So some of them are structural change, how many people will move from agriculture to other sectors like services or industry, how much productivity growth will happen in each of the sectors between now and 2030, what kind of demographic changes we can expect in terms of number of people in different age categories, but also in terms of education of the population, and then what kind of redistribution policies are in place in the country that could mitigate some distributional impacts. So we built a micro simulation model. A micro simulation model is a model that is based on household surveys. And those household surveys, they give us a picture of a population on a given year. So they give us a list of maybe thousands or tens of thousands of different households that are characterized by the number of adults, the number of children, their age, the sectors in which the people work, the number of retired people in the family. And they give us the weight of how representative the household is of the whole population. And then we also know how much each of the person in the household earns, depending on the sector they work in. So we take those surveys, and what we do is that we're going to change the weights in order to project the population in 2030, in order to match a new representation of the population with maybe more households that have educated parents, fewer children, maybe more households with older people. And we do that using an algorithm that's going to match the weight with a new description of the population that we give to the model. So you know, it's an optimization. And then we also increase income in 2030 based on productivity growth in each of the sector for each of the person in the household. Now, if I give you the example of Bangladesh, what happens is that we have the initial income distribution that you can see here based on the household survey today. And then after we put the distribution in our model, we have a new income distribution in 2030 that represents all those changes on population and income growth. And now on top of that, we're going to add climate change impacts. But like I said before, there's a lot of uncertainty on this baseline. So we actually run thousands of baseline scenarios and we end up with a wide range of the number of people who can live in poverty in 2030, depending on our assumptions. We have basically between 150 million people and 600 million people who could live in poverty in 2030, depending on the assumptions we make on all those parameters that I mentioned before. So for each of those baselines, we're going to add climate impacts. And there's also uncertainty on climate impacts, so we add also uncertainty on those. But the types of impact that we model are increases in food prices, decreases in yields and impact on farmers' income, reduced labor productivity for people who work outside, increasing severity and occurrence of floods, drought cyclones, and storm surges, and increases in the prevalence of some diseases. This is an incomplete list of impact. Many more could be added, and the way they're represented is sometimes a bit simplistic, but this is the best that was available globally, based on impact studies that have been published so far. So when we add this in our model, basically what happens is that the income of households is going to be reduced because of all of those channels through which climate change impacts people's income. And if I go back to the example of Bangladesh, this is what happens. So you can see a small change in 2030 compared to the baseline income distribution, which is green. The one with climate change is red, where there's slightly less people that are in the middle and the high end of the income distribution. And you can see on the left that more people are suddenly in the very bottom of the income distribution because they've been pushed in climate change because of. They've been pushed in poverty, sorry, because of climate change. Now, it can be small when you look at it in this way compared to the reduction in poverty that happens between today and 2030. But if you look at it globally, in the worst case scenario, it's still 140 million people that could be pushed into extreme poverty in 2030 because of the impacts of climate change. Here again, there's high uncertainty because it depends on the severity of climate change impacts. And by 2030, the severity of climate change impacts really doesn't depend on emissions because that emissions have already emitted, the ones that are responsible for the 2030 impacts, but they really depend on the adaptive capacity of the population and of the different sectors and ecosystems that we're representing. So in the worst case scenario, 140 million people. And if we look at it on a map, in absolute number, the majority of those people are in sub-Saharan Africa, India, and the rest of South Asia, and Brazil. Now, if we look at it as a percentage of the population, it's much worse in sub-Saharan Africa, and it's also really bad in countries like Bangladesh, for example. Now, in terms of which channels matter the most, it's really the food prices impact and the health impact that are the two channels that push the most people in extreme poverty by 2030. And again, if we look at those impacts on the map, the food prices mostly threaten people in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, and in South Asia. But then the health impacts actually threaten everyone. They're almost equally distributed all over the world in terms of how they will increase extreme poverty in 2030. Now, just to give you some perspective on those numbers. So in our worst case scenario, we find that about 140 million people could be pushed in poverty by 2030 because of climate change. That's the same number of people that are estimated to have been pushed in poverty because of COVID in 2020 and 2021. So it's a large number of people. It's years of progress on poverty reduction that are erased in just 1 year, and that could happen also by 2030 because of climate change. Now, I showed you the worst case scenario, but obviously, if you change the baseline, if you change the assumptions you make on what's going to happen to development and poverty reduction between now and 2030, it changes also the number of people that are vulnerable to climate change impacts. And if we make a lot of optimistic assumptions on development between now and 2030, we actually find much lower climate change impacts. We find 68 million in a scenario that we call optimistic in terms of development. That would be a scenario in which there's universal access to healthcare, modern energy, improved water and sanitation, financial instruments to protect people against the impacts of climate change, the impacts of natural disasters, et cetera, et cetera. If we make all these optimistic assumptions, which means really if we manage to meet the objective of the international community on the sustainable development goals, then the impacts of climate change on poverty could be reduced. But now remember that we're just talking about 2030. And 2030, when you look at climate impacts, is really the short term. We're looking at this window here where there's really little uncertainty on what's going to happen to climate because of global emissions. But by 2100, impacts could be much worse if nothing is done to really reduce global emissions down to zero before the second half of the century, which means that the impacts on poverty, we cannot project them right now because we don't have the data, we don't have enough, we don't have really surveys that we can project so far, but we can imagine that those impacts will be really bad. So really, good development is necessary to reduce the impacts of climate change by 2030, but it's not sufficient. And in addition, the whole world needs to work on reducing their emissions to zero between 2050, 2060, 2070, depending on the scenarios. And here, I just want to say that it seems really unfair that even low and middle-income countries have to reduce their emissions, but we will not meet these objectives if they don't. This graph here is showing what would happen to global emissions by 2060 if only the high-income countries and the upper middle-income countries were reducing their emissions to zero, and if the rest of the world was continuing business as usual. And you see that emissions in 2060 would be 60% of current emissions, which is way too much compared to what needs to happen. So really, all countries have to go to zero, and the good news is that we actually know how to do this. And we have published this other report that is called Decarbonizing Development that really summarizes what needs to happen in four big buckets. First one is decarbonization of electricity generation using renewable energy, mostly, could be carbon capture and storage, but really zero carbon electricity. Once you have zero carbon electricity, you can electrify a lot of other end uses. You can electrify transport, heating, buildings, industries. In order to do this in a way that is really cost efficient, you can also increase efficiency in all sectors. So energy efficiency, water use efficiency, and in agriculture, efficiency in the use of all the nutrients that you usually use. And then finally, there's a need to work on agriculture and land use to really increase productivity and change the agriculture models to preserve forests and natural carbon sinks. Now, when all of this is done, you can basically be at net zero globally. And it's feasible to do. There are many things that developing countries can do now that actually generate a lot of local and immediate benefits. It would make sense to do it even without the constraints of reducing emissions. And that includes, for example, public transportation in cities that have huge co-benefits in terms of reduced congestion, reduced air pollution that have huge economic impacts, and also improved efficiency in the transport systems in cities. Electrification is also something that brings a lot of benefits in terms of fuel savings and health impacts. Air pollution in general has huge health impacts in some developing countries, so decarbonizing the electricity sector, which also generates a lot of air pollution because of coal in some countries like China, makes a lot of sense from a public health perspective. And nowadays, renewable energy is even cheaper than coal. So again, it makes sense to do it even without the need to go to net zero. Now, we talk a lot about carbon taxes. Carbon taxes can be useful for a transition to net zero because they give a good signal to everyone in the economy that, okay, we're getting serious on decarbonizing. But I think the argument for carbon taxes is really that in developing countries, they bring additional fiscal revenues that are usually really needed. It's better to tax energy than to tax consumption or jobs or investments for growth. And evasion is really difficult for carbon taxes because they're taxed at the source. So it's only a few sources where you have to tax compared to value added tax or things like that that are always evaded. And so for low-income countries that have weak fiscal institutions, it actually brings a lot of benefits, carbon taxes, in addition to giving the right signals to the economy. Of course, there are political economy issues. Of course, people hate carbon taxes because they tend to have an impact on consumer, and that impact is problematic. But there are ways to reduce that and even completely reverse it. If the income from carbon taxes were used to compensate people and were redistributed to the rest of the population, the impact could actually be a reduction of inequality thanks to a carbon tax. This is something that is easily feasible by ministries of finance. The problem is that they're not usually communicated to the population. And then finally, the job transition also has a lot of political economy issues. But when we do analysis, and this is in Latin America, an analysis that was done by the Inter-American Development Bank, they found that 21 million jobs could be created by a low carbon economy when 6 million jobs would be destroyed in fossil fuel sectors. So the net impact is positive and highly positive, but of course there's a transition issue and there's a need for governments to protect the workers that are going to lose their jobs. There's a need for retraining, maybe sometimes relocation of workers if they work in provinces or regions that only depend on the fossil fuel industry. So all of this is a lot of work, but all of this is feasible and can really improve development policy, improve the situation in developing countries. So the message here is, it might sound unfair, but there's actually lots of good things that come with deep decarbonization everywhere in the world. So I'm going to stop here and hope that you enjoyed the presentation. Thank you very much.